wanna ask, but I just stare.
You are listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriters. My name is Mark Lintzenmeyer. For episode 14, I'll be talking to Jonathan Donahue from the band Mercury Rev. You are right now listening to part of Car Wash Hair from their first album, Yourself is Steam, from 1991. Jonathan had served as guitarist for the Flaming Lips for a couple of years before forming this band, which had six people out of this first album. On the most recent album, The Light in You, from 2015, there are now only two, Jonathan and his lead guitarist and co-songwriter, who goes by the name of Grasshopper. We're going to be talking about Autumn's in the Air from that new album, then dipping back to their breakthrough Holes from Deserter's Songs, 1998, and then back even further to Empire State, Sun House in Excelsis from See You on the Other Side from 1995. And we're going to wrap up by listening to one more song from the new album called Central Park East. Jonathan gives us a lot of insight into his naturist lyrics and symphonic orchestrations. So apart from technology is he that we had to do this interview by phone. Savage. Hope you like it. Hey, I'm here with Jonathan Donahue. Thank you for doing this.
Sure.
Well, let's get pretty quickly to the first song from the most recent album, The Light in You, 2015. The song is Autumn's in the Air. Do you want to give a little introduction both to this song and to where you were at with this album? I know there was a big gap between this one and the previous album. You're spending time up in the mountains, communing with nature. And this was, in some ways, a callback a little bit to Deserter Songs, which is kind of your breakthrough super symphonic album, in that you were doing a little more electronica, and now you're back into the straight-up orchestration, but this time you're doing all the orchestrations yourself, right?
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, we probably had all the orchestrations ourselves, you know, myself and Dave Friedman and Grasshopper, through the years. I think there was only a small portion of All Is Dream, our 2001 album, where we had Tony Visconti, you know, did some wonderful arrangements for us. And yeah, and you know, we live in the Catskill Mountains. Time goes a little bit slower. We're not in the nexus of the music industry here. And so while I understand that, you know, a lot of young bands have their entire career in a 7-year period, for us, it didn't seem that long. We were very busy, and it doesn't have the same pull maybe later in your years that it does quite early on in your early 20s, to sort of constantly be in the mix of the music business or in the mix of the journalism and the radio and the television and things. And so the 7 years was a lot like seven seasons, probably, for myself. And this album has a lot of romantic side that Deserter Songs had, and even the album before Deserter Songs called See You on the Other Side, with the Disney-esque fairy tale sweeping arrangements that I grew up on. You know, I didn't really grow up on punk rock or even classic rock. I sort of was living in the mountains here in the Catskills from the time I was born, and that stuff didn't really permeate the way it might have in a larger city. And so I was, you know, raised on the music of my parents, to be honest, and it's not very rock and roll, and it's not very cool to say, but that was where I was formed. That was the initial cauldron I was sort of bubbling in, was Walt Disney, was maybe some of the heavier classical pieces of music. And that sort of was embedded in my DNA, you know, right from the beginning. And Grasshopper probably to a large extent as well. He grew up in the sort of hinterlands of Western New York along the Canadian border. And we both had that first blood infusion was from our parents musically. And maybe later on, obviously, you pick up things from friends. But initially, it would have been oldies radio. It would have been children's records and things like that.
Thank you.
sun is on the rise, the colors in the trees are now in my eyes, autumn's in the air, the sun is on the rise, and the colors in the trees are now in my eyes. Walk among the leaves of days not yet to pass. My reflection in the stream, made of mirrored glass. I feel the hourglass fill with memories of sand. They pour into my heart once was in my hand, and the wind begins to trace the many lives I've tried to paint, brushing back the tears across the canvas of my face. Autumn's in the air as parts of me erase. One by one they disappear, like bicycles left chained. Yeah, autumn's in the air, and much to my surprise, a world I thought was black and white turns to watercolor sky. Autumn's in the air, the sun is in my eyes. This must be what it's like to be in Beetle George's mind. Every now and then, when no one else is round, I find myself among the leaves, falling on the ground. Autumn's in the air, the sun is on the rise, and now the color of the trees is the color of my eyes.
Wow. So you're not kidding. I mean, I guess just the fact that it's you doing it and you have this history, I find it hard to listen to a song in isolation in terms of you kind of listen to the band and what you expect from the band. And the fact that you started out with this crazy psychedelic, often getting into noise rock, then it's hard not to take this. I don't know if ironically is the right word, but when you say this is Disney-esque, I guess maybe there's just a nice thing in the culture that psychedelia created this, that yes, you can use elements of that, but it can still be very cool. I mean, it's interesting that it kind of on two levels. I heard another interview with you where you and Grasshopper were, one of you was saying, people ask us, are you going to do a children's record? And you say, oh, they're all children's records. So you could sort of take it like this, but you could also take it at a second level.
I mean, that was what your self-esteem was our initial version of orchestration. It's mm-hmm. just that I didn't have access to violins. I can't read or write notes. on a sheet music. And so I was working with the only tools that I was handy with, which was feedback and multiple layers of guitars and the dynamics of, you know, guitars and feedback sort of flying out of the speakers and layers of sort of small, subtle cinematic sounds, whether it was waves or just ambient sort of soundtrack style stuff on the first album. That's what I was doing. It was just a very poor man's version of what later I would begin to sort of work with oboes and flutes. But initially, that's what I thought I was doing. Now, I realized to most people, it just sounded like noise and feedback. But in the studio, while we were doing that with Dave Fridman and Grasshopper and David Baker and Suzanne on the flute, to us, it was sort of an orchestration. It's just we didn't have the fundamental skills to apply it in the very conventional, classical way. But all the songs, if you listen to them on your self-esteem, most of them are very long, and most of them are only two chords. So within that, we had to work with motifs or atmospheres of a section, because we the only ones who could read and write music were Dave Fridman and Suzanne, and Grasshopper to a degree as well. But the rest of us were completely clueless as to how to describe getting to a certain section or making it open up in a note form or in a scale or something like that. So the words we would use were never musical Italian terms. They were basically, you know, here's the part where the thunder bursts and witches fly out or something silly like that, because I didn't have the lexicon. And that wouldn't come until later through experimentation and basically a lot of fumbling around in the dark until sort of Deserter Sons, where we began to hit a stride, or maybe it just opened up to us a lot clearer than it was. But initially, your self-esteem, it was an orchestral record. It's just I didn't have the fundamental skills to apply it to an orchestra. So I had to use feedback, and Grasshopper and Dave Fridman were really good at capturing some of those ideas as under the soil as they probably sound today.
When you started on the this method of writing that you used in Deserter Songs, and then it sounds like you're still using here, so you described that you were just picking out these simple melodies on piano. And I hear definitely, even though there's very lush orchestration, like it's all led by this thing that the xylophone and the guitar are playing at the beginning, and then, you know, it goes into the main big riff where you've got the harp over, which is again xylophone led the first time, and then you've got this oboe riff later, and even the main melody is just very Disney, I guess, as you're saying.
Well, the idea is that's what orchestration is. You're taking little melodies and you're just applying them to various different instruments, and, you know, the same melody can be played on an oboe and restated on 12 violins. That's orchestration. Initially, we didn't have any of that sort of around us other than the guitars and the feedback and the flute. And so, yeah, there was basically simple melodies that are reiterated, or in our way, we were trying to orchestrate them. Like I say, we didn't have the wherewithal or the money or the technical prowess to apply these in a much more standard way. So initially, yeah, you're dealing with melodies. That's how we picked it up from albums like Ocean Rain by Echo and the Bunnymen. If you listen to it, there's lots of little string melodies and piano little things, but they're really all following Will Sargent's leads. They're following the little vocal melodies that come out of the guitar. And that was basically the beginning of songwriting as orchestration for us, was albums that we began to notice that it isn't a mystical science, that you're playing a simple melody and then you're restating it in many different ways, as grand or as small as you like. So that was basically, in a nutshell, the approach we had making your self-esteem. And also the fact that we were quite young.
So did this start with those little melodies, or did this start with the text here, this Autumn's in the Air?
Well, with Autumn's in the Air, which, you know, is 25, almost 30 years in now, there is a little bit of experience you can rely on. You can find the little thematic moments and then begin to dissolve yourself right into the song itself. You know, lyrically, there might be a phrase or two that would begin and sort of spark the rest of the song's content. And autumn's in the air. That's the phrase. You know, it just began. We live in the Catskills. Autumn's everywhere. It lights up in everybody's eyes. Beginning in September, it's very visceral for us here.
Yeah, it sounds like the whole thing is just, it's one moment frozen. There's no story in the song. It's just all describing this. If there is any progression in the story, it's sort of as this feeling is filling you throughout the song as it progresses or something.
Okay.
It looks like. Or you can tell me. We get to the third little section here. I feel the hourglass fill with memories of sand. I don't want to try to force you to say, well, what do you mean by this? I mean, because it's a line of poetry. And if the whole point is that it's an image that you're throwing out and it's purposefully kind of ambiguous and evocative and that's all there is to it, that's fine. But do you have anything to say about that particular comment on time here?
I suppose it's reflection. It's a self-reflection process. And I suppose that's, you know, what the seasons are for me. Maybe that's what the autumn is in the air. You can see it's representing in a way for the writer, the singer, the speaker in the song. It's a self-reflexive action that is sort of a feedback loop. But the seasons are passing, and that is, it's a process. I wouldn't say it's necessarily a single moment, but it's a process that seems to feed back upon itself, creating a larger and greater wave each time the cycle goes through. And I wouldn't say that's it in a nutshell, but if that's all that the listener takes away, then so be it.
That makes sense in terms of the, I feel the hourglass fill with memories of sand. They pour into my heart, which was what once was in my hand. So the feedback loop there. And the wind begins to trace the many lives I've tried to paint, brushing back the tears across the canvas of my face. I guess I understand that in terms of what you were just saying, the sort of internalizing past emotional expressions. It sort of sounds like you're talking about relating to your own past creative output and kind of using that to feed your soul. Does that sound right? Or
yeah, I think that's incredibly valid, what you're saying. That's what I've tried to convey in the song. You know, if there's something that you or anybody else seems to hit a wall with, and that's my fault of not being able to relate it as well as I probably would have liked to using words. But it is, it's that mirror-like process of looking into nature and seeing that the processes of nature around you are the very same going on in you. And that's probably something that's been lyrically in our records for many, many years now. And it's not very rock and roll. And it often hits a wall with people where they're saying, okay, you're talking about the autumn or the winter, and we get that kind of thing, but we're still sort of running into this rock wall of what does that mean? And all I can say is, to me, that is the part and the process that I'm enamored with, of seeing yourself in the waters coming back to you. And, you know, for years I've been trying to do my best to explain that I know it's not very rock and roll. It's not very current. It's not necessarily the edginess of singing about drugs or anything else. But I'm okay with that. You know, I have to be. That's what's sincere in me is this process. And it's what I'm surrounded by. It's what I'm immersed by in the mountains. And so it is my lexicon. Nature and the world above and below me is the machine language I've been programmed with. And so for me to sing in about or in any other way, you know, though I've probably tried in the past, it generally doesn't have the same import or the same depth of something like an autumn's in the air. And as a songwriter, as an artist, you're always trying to break out of your own self. You're always trying to dissolve the hard edges around you, songwriting and lyrically. But at times, what's in you really fundamentally, with that spin that you have, that is really what does connect with people. And all the other side aspects that you may wish to fabricate or you may wish to enhance or in some way embellish, they just roll off people's backs because people can understand that, okay, for Jonathan, this is where the blood is, right here. You know, and for another singer, whether it's the Velvet Underground, it's the city life, and that's where the blood is pumping, and things on the side of that may be a little bit less focused or a little less close to the heart.
So what you were saying about seeing yourself reflected in nature, that's very much vivid in the last couple stanzas. There's the one transitional one right after the across the canvas of my face that I'm still a little unclear about. The autumn's in the air as parts of me erase. One by one, they disappear like bicycles left unchained. The way I was interpreting that is the whole song is just getting swept up by this feeling of nature and feeling oneness with nature. And so that's the parts of you erasing is the erasing the sense of self. Although I'm not sure I get the like bicycles left chained. What is that? It's that leaves gradually grow over them and you don't see them anymore. Is that?
Yeah, it has that. I suppose that, you know, that effect of every day you walk to work and someone left a bicycle left chained out by the store. And each day you pass by, the wheel is gone and the seat is gone and someone keeps stealing all of these little parts of this hard structure that once was a bicycle, that was a vehicle for you to get somewhere. And much like the process of nature, the seasons, autumn, one by one, these parts of me are disappearing, these structures that I've built. And this is not a fundamental process just to me. I think it happens to everyone at points that where all these little belief systems you've had, all these little Jonathans that you've created, one by one begin to dissolve. Maybe they're not even dissolving. Some of them are shattering. Maybe not even by your own accord, but by just the outside world just sort of rips them apart. And that is that process of reflecting. That is that process of self-realization, I suppose, on a very small level.
All right. I can see how the mood and the lyrics have come out of this self-reflective experience. Now, when you actually get to the nitty-gritty, you were saying that you, how do you orchestrate if you can't read music and you're not just dictating it to a producer somewhere who's then saying, okay, I'll translate this so that the 15-piece orchestra that I bring in can understand what you're trying to say?
That is part of the learned experience through the records and through the years is where I can begin to hear. I hear in colors mostly. Mm-hmm. And so I'm able to do what I can to say, well, I've got this underlying theme here. And I'd like it to, you know, really stretch out a bit. And so I will begin to put it on a string section or maybe take it way down and just do it on a small acoustic guitar. Whatever the case may be, I do have that skill set evolving in me. It's certainly not evolved to Shostakovich levels, but it's evolved to Jonathan levels where I can begin to see where I want colors to be. And I have a pretty good idea of what instruments represent those colors to me through the years. And so, yeah, then I would take it and I'd say, okay, let's orchestrate this moment using these colors, these paints. And that's something that I do work really hard at. It always hasn't come natural to me. I didn't grow up thinking I'd be a composer or anything like it.
Mm-hmm.
So I do have to work really hard at it. There is a lot of trial and error. There is a lot of erasing in a Mercury Rev recording session. There's more erasing than there is recording. And that's okay. You come to accept that and to enjoy that part of it and not get too precious.
Just in terms of the actual tools you're using, are you creating a little recording of this where you are singing or playing on a keyboard what the string part is going to be, and then the MIDI file or whatever gets converted by a program to written notes, or you're just simply writing it out at this point?
Initially, it would be like, you know, we were talking on a little cassette. I'd sort of hammer out a little vocal melody, and then I'd add in a little lyrical phrase that was swimming around inside of me. And then from there, yeah, just like most people, I would jump on a piano if I wasn't already on one, or maybe we have a, you know, some old organs here, and just sort of sketch out the top line, the overarching theme, perhaps. And from there, when we went into a larger studio, we'd begin to score the underneath parts of it, whether it's the brass or the percussion, or just figure out the size of an orchestra. You know, it's easy once you begin using orchestral instruments, whether they're live or used in from the MIDI world, it's easy to misinterpret that orchestra means big. Orchestra means great. And that's something you don't want to fall into. And everybody does initially. I don't care who you are. But after a while, you begin to scale back a bit and you realize that size doesn't necessarily mean importance in that way. It's the same way when you hear someone these days just strumming along on an old guitar, wearing an old flannel shirt with a beard down to their knees, and they're attempting to intimate this old, weathered, experienced feel into their song. But you can see it's a 24-year-old kid. And at times you can mistake recording on a dusty old piano for something that Billie Holiday made. And it's not the same. So when you're dealing with orchestrations, you have to be really careful and really vigilant to not get swept up literally in the classicalness of it and not mistake just the fact that you're using session string players somehow gives a greater gravitas to what you're doing. A poorly written song is still a poorly written song, no matter how many French horns you load on top of it.
Now, I know if you're just doing a session with one, you know, a flute player or a guest guitarist or something, then you can switch things up on the fly. You can, okay, hey, do this. I have another riff in my head to do in this one part. But if you have a, you know, a 15-piece string section in there, you can't really do that. I mean, are there times where you get the fellas in there and they start playing the part and maybe you're finding, wow, this is too much. This is kind of more, if it's the first time you're actually hearing it with the strings playing it, are you getting some surprises that you kind of have to correct on the fly there?
Absolutely, all the time. That's where the money comes from, you know, in terms of if you just left it to the classical players themselves, all they're doing is reading notes, numbers on the sheet. And so the personality and the playfulness and the imagination has to come from the band. Because generally speaking, most classical musicians, they're not thinking in terms of feeling. They're thinking in terms of performance. And so, yeah, of course, that's why sessions get expensive. Because guys like me are running around, no, make it sound like a waterfall gushing. And all of a sudden it slams into the side of a Mack truck. And they're going, what the F are you talking about? We're just playing notes. And then I have to work backwards at how to interpret notes. Or maybe I've made a colossal error orchestrating a part. And I've got to go back on the fly and say, okay, I was way wrong on guiding us over the past hour during your lunch break, people, in this way. It doesn't sound very good at all. Let's backtrack a bit. So there's an awful lot of that that goes on. Both because of my imagination of where I want it to go beyond the written note and because of my fundamental lack of being able to read and write music. I rely a lot on Grasshopper and people around me as well to help me interpret and learn quickly on the fly at very expensive hourly rates the language of classical musicians. Now, through the years, Mark, I've gotten better at doing so much experimentation before I get to that stage that I do have a much better idea. And the experimentation is a lot of fun, and part of it is self-preservation. I can't afford 9 days in a studio with a string quartet. Most people can't. And so I got to do a lot of it on my own, trying every different way possible so that I've exhausted some things. And what's left might be the most sincere way forward.
Well, I noticed, like, interestingly, there's a, I think it's over when you say Autumn's in the Air as Parts of Me Erase, that this counter vocal comes in, this, that, like, well, that could have been a big string part, but instead it's a single vocal. Although I noticed when I saw a clip of you recently live, that was sort of part of the backing recording. You didn't have just, you know, the bass player go, there.
Yeah. You know, that's probably because that's Ken Stringfellow, and we worked with him on this record for the first time. Now we've known him 20 years. And one of his strongest suits is vocals. And that's one of the things we asked him. We said, hey, it's something we haven't developed fully to this point in our time. Would you come in and really help us develop counter vocal melodies? He has a high range like Grasshopper, but he can really get up there and fly in a way that I can't. And this was incredibly liberating for us that we could begin to use the male voice, especially on this record, in a way that we were using other instruments. And yeah, live, there's just no way any of us could hit that high note. Grasshopper probably could, but he's so busy playing that to hit it accurately, just probably wouldn't happen on a daily basis. But that was a big step forward for us on a song like Autumn's in the Air or Amelie or some of the other ones on the new album, was working with Ken, who again is almost a composer in his own right with vocals.
Sure.
He loves working with backing vocals. He adores it. He doesn't find it a chore. It comes so naturally to him that it can't help but sort of gain your own momentum, increase it. And it certainly did on this album.
Well, and I also like, you know, when you get to the biggest orchestral flourish part in the Autumn's in the Air, The Sun Is in My Eyes, I guess this must be what it's like to be in Beetle George's mind, that you introduce a little Beatle-y, a little Georgie riff there that then keeps kind of playing. And even though it's fairly understated in the mix and low, that this is playing against this giant rolling orchestra. It's just a cool juxtaposition there.
Yeah, you know, we do a lot of little moments like that that sometimes go very unnoticed in our records, and that's okay. But sometimes you can hear them, like that little George riff that Grasshopper came up with. It's just a cinematic little detail, like a small moment in the back of a Hitchcock film where you just notice in the background the third time through watching it, hey, look at that. What does that mean? What does that number mean over there in the corner of that Fellini scene? And that's something we do love. We work so hard. That's where we get our rocks off, is taking these very simple songs, though you may not grasp it on the first listen. They're very simple songs, four chords, most of them. And we love to enhance them or put those little Christmas lights in the background blinking. And you'll find that from the very first album, but you'll certainly find it in the later records where we don't mind paying a little homage to George with a little George-like riff. That's something that we probably spend a lot of time in the studio working those smallest moments, those smallest details.
So, for instance, when you get the harp player in there, was that more like getting the string players in there? Was that more like getting Ken Stringfellow in there? That if you got an individual playing a harp, and I would imagine that's even the hardest thing to write out a part for, in terms of if you're actually having to write.
Yeah, the harp, I totally understand where you're coming from. I don't really write for the harp, much more using symbols and metaphors. Can you make it sound like a bubbling stream? There's no way I could write all the scales and how they articulate the arpeggios. And there you are relying on a harp player or the harp player's understanding of your picturesque phraseology to say, okay, you know, obviously we can say, well, do a gliss here. But when you get to the top of the gliss, trickle back down in a sort of bubbling stream way, or maybe don't gliss fully. Or again, a lot of it is a very sound vocabulary that I use with classical people or just session people sometimes to get to where I can sort of go, because I'm using almost entirely visual imagery when I'm writing and orchestrating. And therefore, I've got to find some numbers and notes to go along with that. And therein lies the rub.
More touring bands should have a harp player like that. That they, it's such a flexible instrument. You know, you had a flute for a while. Why not a giant harp to just go sit alongside the guitars? That,
yeah, it's expensive on the plane.
We should transition to the second song here. So this is from Deserter Songs, 1998. The song is the opening track from there. It's Holes. We've said a lot about the general approach that resulted in this and then that evolved to get to the Light in You songs. Any other comments to introduce this one?
Yeah, it's one of those late night songs that came to me in the blink of an eye. It wrote itself in the way that some of the best ones do. It had an impact I couldn't foresee on people. Probably my favorite moment in the song is the bowed saw.
Yes.
Yeah.
I was thinking that was a theremin. Okay, so it's a musical saw.
No, it's a bowed saw.
Maybe there are really good theremin players that can control their tone a little better, but the bowed saw, that's a very distinctive tune. Okay, well, let's play it.
All along red lines,
control of all the smoke like streams that flow into your dreams. That big blue open sea. Drop like flies.
both of these songs structurally are very interesting because it's not like you've got the verse and then you've got the chorus. When Autumn's in the Air, it's pretty much the one four line phrase that is just a few chords and that repeats over and over again. Here, it's more just like one line that just repeats, at least vocally. So it's kind of a lot of work in terms of how are you going to arrange this so it sounds, you know, it has a progression so that the orchestration makes it worth going on as long as it is, because it's just the same vocal line.
Well, it's four chords over and over again. And this is where the orchestration, not only in our songs, but in lots of people's rock songs, but certainly in classical music, this is how it works. Is you have one main, shall we say, movement, and in whole it's four chords, but it's the counter melodies that give all of the movement, that give all of this discerning parts to it, that give the rise and give the fall and give the dynamics. And generally speaking, you know, in classical music and certainly in wholes, it's the French horns that give the rise and give the emotion. You know, the chords themselves, the main chords, are just providing sort of the candlelight and the atmosphere. But it's the French horns and the underlying counter melodies and some of the bowed saw that give the emotional context of where you are, not only in that part of the song, but in the song as a whole.
So it's that main horn riff that comes in at the end of all the blinking lights. You had to pick the one tonight. So this sort of the end of one of the main phrases, and you have a little instrumental part, and you've got this very cinematic horn part, but that's exactly the place where you have the bowed saw that comes in that to me makes it sound more like this is trippy and psychedelic. This is not just from a movie. There's something else going on here.
Well, the bowed saw to me, it's one of my favorite instruments because it's very close to the human voice, you know, granted an operatic style, but that's why I love it so much, more than the theremin, which is a little colder. And we used a lot of theremin on the last record before Deserter's Song, so I didn't want to go there again. So we found a bowed saw player, because at the time I didn't play it. Now I do, but at the time of Deserter's, we didn't. So we had to journey all the way up the coast to Maine to find a guy who could play it competently. And it has that feel close to, in Indian music, as an instrument called the sarangi, which is a violin-esque style instrument, which is basically there as a vocal instrument. And that's where the emotion comes from. That's where that chill comes up your spine. It's the bowed saw. Otherwise, it would just sort of have an open section without any greater import. And the bowed saw, to me, was that moment. It was that instrument. Where I found the bowed saw first was in the very last scene of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, where the bowed saw comes in, and I think it was orchestrated, you know, by Jack Nietzsche. That moment in the cuckoo's nest really left a great impression on me. And I thought, wow, that, what is that? And it was the bowed saw, and that's the direct lineage of the bowed saw into Mercury Rev.
That seems an appropriate reference because it, to me, it doesn't connote so much opera as something insane is happening here. It's beautiful, but it's the thing that makes it sound more psychedelic than Disney.
Sure. I mean, again, it's so open to interpretation, like the voice, that I'll take anything that anybody says about the bowed saw generally as sincere, because it has that open-ended, mournful, almost melancholy tone, timbre to it, that once you hear it, it seems to just strike right inside of you. It doesn't sort of bounce off your skin like a lot of other instruments do. It finds its way right into your armor.
Another thing it really adds to the texture here, I mean, right at the beginning of the song, you've got this kind of drone. It's sort of like it's going to be a Pink Floyd tune or something with strings. But then you've got this spacey keyboard that comes in. That's a really kind of a thick sound. And I almost expect, given that sound, for a really fast... Well, I was just listening to the Bill Laswell remix of this song where you have a fast, like a fast electronic drum thing. And that keyboard at least connotes to me like, oh, something like that's going to happen. But no, it just adds to the thickness of the texture.
Yeah, the main keyboard thing that's sort of hammering out the notes, that's just the Wurlitzer roll top. But it adds to what you would find in a lot of our songs as sort of a baseline, is the mantra-esque quality, where nearly every song on the new record began with me using a tambura drone and just playing on top of a tambura. And that's something that Grasshopper and I have been into for 30 years. And again, we orchestrate on top of it, so it's not necessarily evident. But underlying nearly three quarters of Mercury Rev songs is a drone. Even if we erase the drone at the end when we're mixing, it almost always begins with a drone.
It's kind of interesting. Before you get to that main, the Wurlitzer, that electric piano part that's da-no-na-no-na, you've got the orchestra doing basically that part, but it's not just the da-no-na-no-na. It's actually kind of goes back and forth between do-na-no-na-no-na-na-no-na. Like,
that was Grasshopper on guitar. He wrote the riff, and then he and Suzanne played it on, I think, clarinet and their flute. You know, but again, it began, like you said before, with a simple guitar melody. And then we said, hey, instead of just the guitar, let's, you know, Grasshopper plays clarinet and Susie played flute. So they just jumped in there and did the part. But it was written on guitar.
Now, the melody of this and the lyrics and the tone, I mean, the name Holes, I don't know if this was intentional or it's just the tone of your voice, but it very much sounds like some of the Neil Young stuff when he's doing like the ballad that he did for the soundtrack of Philadelphia or something, where, you know, just a really nice. So you've got an established model for somebody that can be singing high like that, not piercing, almost the, I guess one reviewer that I saw has described as a childlike sound. I don't think that works. That's exactly right. But seems like it was a little bit of a jump over a couple albums before you got to this style of singing, right? That when you took over on lead vocals.
Yeah. Well, I think it took a while for the music itself to simmer down a bit. It's hard to sort of come through with that fragility. And, you know, my voice, it does crack when I get up there. You know, it does have that hiss and warble to it that I can't control. It's just the way it comes out. But initially on some of the earlier records, the music was quite loud. You know, the drums were pounding, there was feedback, and there was just no way to see myself in those songs with that voice. And as the music began to get a lot more plaintive and quieter in feel on the other side, that voice began to sort of reveal itself. And yeah, when I'm working with very simple chord arrangements on a guitar or on a piano, that's where the voice goes. You know, it has that Neil Young, George Harrison-esque style to it, just by the fact that it doesn't have to screech and growl and shout to hear itself.
Any comments about what this means? Time, all the long red lines that take control of all the smoke-like streams that flow into your dreams. Like, I'm hesitant to ascribe any literal meaning to this. It just sounds like cool imagery. But what were you thinking here?
I'm probably hesitant to put it into words, too. And in the case of Holes, there's a lot more of an atmosphere and a feeling than I would like to point to a direct, here's what I was thinking, here's what it means. Because over time, it's taken on greater and different meanings than it did when I wrote it, I don't know, nearly 20 years ago. And sometimes that happens, that the moment I think, oh, I've nailed this song and it's definitely what I wanted it to say, give me 10 years, Mark, and I'll completely reverse my position on it. Because songs and art don't seem to work that way. The best of them seem to grow, and the more that people listen to it, the more it takes on a much more universal aspect to what you were trying to describe than one that's very personal and specific. So I don't even dip my feet in those waters anymore to really say, here's exactly what I meant, and this is only what the song means. I learned that quite quickly after Deserter Songs, to shy away from thinking I actually knew exactly what a song meant.
Well, that's kind of one of the fun things, that when I've written something, I might look back on it and my interpretation is just as much of a guess, is just as much of an interpretation as any third person's. It's just, you know, I have, of course, a little extra insight on where I was when I wrote the song and what kind of thing. But yeah, in terms of the literal meaning of things, yeah, that's entirely the point of a certain kind of poetry.
Yeah, it seems to be the point of art when you come to some realization that's beyond just the small little you that thinks you're making it. You realize you're more like a faucet, and this stuff is flowing through you. And the less you try to claim it as just your own, the more universal and the more people can see themselves inside of that painting as well. And this doesn't come with youth. It comes with experience and getting knocked around a little bit in the world that you inhabit artistically, whatever world that is. And that's a big step forward, I think, for a songwriter, a painter, a poet, doesn't matter. It's a big step forward to stop seeing what you're doing as so personal and instead see it more, again, as a reflection of something much more universal that's going on in a lot of human beings. Maybe not all. It's not meant to represent every human ever on Earth. But in a certain way, the more it can have a little bit of a note that rings the bell in other people, that's when you find you're really onto something special.
Nonetheless, I want to push you a little bit on some of the meanings here. Just, I certainly hear the yearning and just talking about distance and the ocean that can't be crossed and, distant gods. And, but then of all those blinking lights, you had to pick the one tonight. Mm-hmm. Any thoughts about that line?
I know where I was sort of emotionally at the time, writing Holes, and it was in a very dark place. And I don't mean self-pitying, but just in a place where I couldn't see any familiar landmarks anymore. The band was at a really low point. A lot of things had shattered or fallen away. And I just didn't have a star in the sky that I could locate myself by. And some of that ocean that can't be crossed and the distance and the fading signs, I suppose they were, you know, the references that I could make to that isolation and that feeling of placelessness, that I didn't have a way to orient myself. I couldn't find a compass close enough by that I could say, here's where I am and here's where I want to go. It was like being on the ocean floor. The only thing you know is that you're at the bottom. You can't see how far it is up. No light's penetrating down. The pressure is incredible. The beings that are around you are completely distorted. All you hear is silence and your own sort of heartbeat. And that was probably what was very much infused into Holes and maybe a few other moments in Deserter Songs itself. And so any of the terminology or the lyrical phrases would likely be these sort of prismatic colors that I could make out at the time.
All right. I guess a little more with the arrangement. How does that old song go? And you've got the French horns doing their bah, bah, nah thing again, but then you have, what is it, a trumpet solo, or is it a flugelhorn something? It's about the same pitch as the French horns. It's interesting that it sort of fights them a little bit, that you've got the nice cinematic French horn part that they've heard before, but then you've got this solo that comes out rolling over it.
We were doing a lot with another sort of side project called the Harmon Rockets at the time, and working with some of that more mellow side of the trumpet, the cornet, the flugelhorn, not dissimilar to Sketches of Spain or something like mm-hmm. that, where we were really enamored with that timbre. And that had a way to reflect back on how does that old song go, like an older moment, maybe in the 40s or something, where a horn might have come in somewhat like that. And again, it was a small reference of ours, but once we heard it performed by the guy who played it, you know, we knew we didn't want to go back to the saw again and do the saw again in the song. We wanted that moment for that horn. And it, again, you're looking for some texture to ring that emotional bell in you. And that was the one that seemed closest at the time.
So with both of these songs, with Autumn's in the Air and Holes, the arrangements are really rich in terms of, it's almost like every line or every phrase, every couple lines, something new has to enter or has to kind of show itself. Like the camera is panning around and a new thing is highlighted. And one of the most skillful things I feel like you do is not to simply build one thing on another until there's way, way, way too much. That somehow these things, even though, okay, now the rim shot is entering for this part, bah, 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 it sounds like it's always building, but yet obviously some of those things are not sticking around, but you don't notice them. It seems very hard. Like once you start a rim shot going, like, okay, well then just have it stop without it sounding like a letdown.
Yeah, that came with experience too. When you're young, you figure, no, more is better. Just keep layering and piling on. And as you go forward, you realize that there has to be something receding for something to appear like it's approaching. That takes a while to learn how to do it. It's something we love to do, so we do it more often than many bands do. And yeah, our music, it has a cinematic feel, but it also has a very dimensional feel. And some people can interpret that. If you're used to listening to three-chord guitar rock, you're going to say it's really dense. But for someone maybe who's more intuitive in terms of cinematic songs or soundtracks or classical music, you might see it as a more orchestrated textures. And that's the way we prefer to see it, because it's probably the way that we listen to music. And we're not a three-piece rock band. We've never pretended to be. And we take our lumps when people say, oh, it's very complex and it's dense and there's lots going on. There's too much. I don't know what I'm listening to. That's okay. It's not meant for everybody. We're not trying to out-soul asylum, Soul Asylum. They're a great band because they are sincere in what they do. And what we love to do, we feel we're very sincere in the paintings that we are trying to create and relay. And so anything that anyone can say about Mercury Red in terms of what you're describing of the colors and the panoramas, it's probably accurate. I'm not going to fight anybody on it. They can see whatever they want to see in it. It's like a great film. There's tons in The Wizard of Oz to go and watch it 60 times, or Fantasia, or any of the other films. But if you just want to watch it once as a child, there's so much right on the surface as well. And that's something that I'm okay with. It took me a while to accept it, but I'm okay with that perspective of whatever people want to come at Mercury Rev for or against. I'm not going to stand in your way, you know?
Well, I just wonder how, you know, people might say, oh, you know, you're bringing in classical influences or something, but there seems a distinct difference to me between the approach to writing music, which is, I think, originating with pop music, where you're working basically with a recording, where even if it's just your demo of you singing on a cassette, and then you're thinking about what you're layering on top of that, that seems fundamentally different to me than somebody who's simply working with paper. And, you know, the reason that Haydn or somebody could write so many opuses so quickly is because they're kind of, it's almost mathematical. Like you were saying that you were likewise, okay, I start with a simple melody and we're presenting it in different ways with different instruments, but it seems very different than, can I twirl this out in sonata form? It's not a piece.
Well, first of all, they wouldn't be dealing with the vocals, which changes everything, you know, and yeah, of course, classical composers are dealing with structures just like the Beatles were. They're dealing with rondo forms and all these other things I don't know much about. And like you say, there is a mathematics involved in strict composing in the classical world that I can't even approach. I couldn't even tell you what it is. But I know it exists, intervals and writing, and some of it just, it's mathematics. Whereas, yeah, I'm dealing in probably more of a pop world, and I'm having to work with my own vocals and my own lyrics. So I have a couple of things that maybe can broaden my own writing, but there are also limitations as well. I don't have the voice of Paul McCartney, you know. I don't have some of the other tools, so I have to work with what I have. And in that way, the classical writing can be more evocative, but it can be much more formalized than even something on Sgt. Pepper's. Because the story there has to just work with frequencies of sound, and you don't have to have the added emotional inflection of the vocal, unless, of course, you're writing opera. And for most of us, opera is in a different language, Italian or German. So even that's going way over our heads. It's much more just like an instrument.
Yeah, or the way the voices in opera are singing, that the way you sing is within a stone's throw of talking. I'm not saying that you're not using a melody. It's not Lou Reed. It's not that kind of, but it's something that is very easy to relate to in a way that an opera voice is more like listening to a horn. Frankly.
Yeah, very much so, especially because most of us don't speak Italian. So we're not
true.
Getting the lyrical import. And if you read most of the lines in opera, you're going, really? That's what that person's saying all about now? Man.
And an opera in English often just sounds wrong. Like,
yeah.
That's
because
not the way
not,
a human voice
is. We're using rhyming. themes like is traditional in most Western pop music. They're not using the lexicon even. You know, you can use words as the and thus and crazy old English phrases in opera, where in modern music, you're working in a much more, in a way, limited form. Even if you're using beat poetry or something, you're still working generally, at least we do, for the most part, in a rhyming context. You know, so the challenge there is immense to try to come up with new rhyming couplets and phrases that perk people like yours' interest, even for a moment, because there's only so many rhymes you can come up with. You know, it's a sort of limited batch of numbers. And so we're working really hard, as anybody, singer-songwriter these days, to just stand out a bit and get inside of your, get past your eardrum and into your sort of brain, because that's the wall that most of us in music hit, is we're hitting your eardrum as a wall. It's actually not a vibrating timpani. It's more like a wall that we've got to find our way around, because your eardrum and most people's, it's so used to being bombarded by a beat, by a tempo, and by some sort of an instrumentation that it just tunes it out like background noise. It's like listening to the highway next to your house.
Yeah, I got to say, I had to kind of recalibrate myself when I started playing your new album, and it didn't have giant drums at first. You didn't start out with Are You Ready? If that was the first track, I might not have gotten this impression, but that it kind of had to, I think that's a big dividing line between older people, you know, pre-rock, my dad who's 80 something, that, you know, if you've gotten used to having the beat there as a piece of furniture, as a constant, then it's hard to listen to anything that doesn't have that without kind of feeling a little frustrated or something. And likewise, you know, if you're raised in the pre-rock world and then hear things with a beat like that, then that can just be a wall you're running against.
That's exactly it. You hit it right on the head. Having a drum beat there initially is like a piece of furniture. It's like walking into a party and there's a space open on the couch you can sit down on. And go, okay, I'm at the party, I can sit down, cool. But imagine going to a lot of parties where there's nowhere to sit, or it's too crowded, or it's just awkward. And that's, for some people, without that initial beat, without the vocal coming in from the very beginning, or the hook line, it can be a little bit throwing them in a strange place. And that's what, you know, it's something we work with a lot, so we're used to it. But for most bands, the first thing you learn is put the beat on. Stop messing around. What are you going through this quiet bit at the beginning? Get us to the chorus. Get us to the thundering kick and snare. Don't make us sit around and look awkwardly at the party for a place to stand.
You know, it actually took me a while to get to that point of being okay with the beat as a piece of furniture, because I started in orchestra and choir, and even though I liked some kinds of rock music, I liked when the drums were being an instrument and kind of didn't listen to it as rock. I just listened to it as here's a piece and the drums are doing something interesting here. So when I got to a band like The Cure, where the drums are not designed to do anything interesting, like they are just a beat to sort of give you a thing to then listen to the rest of the song while you're leaning on this spot. So sounds like you guys never went through a period where you were treating the drums that way. You were always a little more self-conscious about your arrangement, even from the start.
I think so. I think just because initially we didn't have that tool with us of a steady beat. We came at it, just Grasshopper and I and David Baker and Suzanne, from much more of just the cinematic way. So we weren't looking to hold someone's attention for 3 minutes and 29 seconds via a drum beat and a pulsing bass. It took a while to even work some of those elements into our own music. You know, and that's, again, that's coming from early childhood. We just didn't grow up, you know, listening to that style of music. So it didn't come as our first impression when we began making our own music.
Well, let's bring the third song into our little discussion here, Empire State, with the subtitle Sun House in Excelsis. So from See You on the Other Side, 1995. So it's only the album right before Deserter Songs, but it was a leap forward. And we've got a different sort of take on the vocals. It sounds more like, I don't know, Modest Mouse than Neil Young. I know Modest Mouse is later than you guys, so that's not a rip. And much lower in the mix, too. The voice seems to just have a different role here.
Yeah, I mean, you could see we had a an original singer who would, you know, sing half the songs with me for the first two albums, David Baker. And after mm-hmm. he left, following the second album, the majority or all the vocals fell to me alone, as opposed to 50% on the other albums. And so it was a process of finding not only my own footing as a singer and my own limitations and everything that went with that, but also finding a music that could suit much more my own stylings or my own strength at that time as a singer. And so, you know, the music became a lot more melodic, maybe even more harmonic. It became sort of quieter in moments in some of the songs, not all of them, but in some. It was more musically playful than maybe the forceful feedback maelstrom that had gone before it. You know, so a lot of it is sort of melting back down. It was that caterpillar melting back down into almost nothing before it would emerge again later in Deserter songs. So it was a process of taking all the harder structures, all the metals that we had had earlier, and sort of melting them back down to recast them as new and different bells, if you were.
Any introductory words on this particular song of what it's about? Or,
well, from the very beginning, along with some of the childlike fairy tale Disney-esque moments, something that Grasshopper and I were always very into was some of the minimal avant-garde people. And it's some of it we studied with in Buffalo when we were both at college there, Tony Conrad. And we fell in love with a lot of the Steve Wright, early Philip Glass, Pauline mm-hmm. Oliveros. And that's probably one of the songs, Empire State, where you can begin to really hear some of the context of that avant-garde music that we did love. The minimal side, not necessarily the noisiest parts of Charles Gale or Ornette Coleman, but the softer side. So when you hear the insistent beginning of Empire State on the piano, it's not a far stretch to walk over and say, okay, Steve Reichian or Philip Glass, some of the arpeggiated moments there. And that was something that we always tried to find a way to bring out some of that love that we had for that in a more pop context. Granted, stuff on See You on the Other Side and Empire State, it's a 7-minute song. We're not competing with I Want to Hold Your Hand. But just in the presentation with it, that was something we always found a welcome sort of challenge, you know, whether it was vibraphones or pianos or something like that, where we could have a little bit of playful fun with some of the love that we had for Steve Reich and some of those kind of people.
Back into the night, one heel in front, one heel behind.
I see what you're saying with the minimalism, with this insistent eighth note keyboard. Tick, 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 tick. I wrote chopsticks keyboard, that it's some sort of chord cluster. You've got some notes that are close together. It's not, and it goes interestingly 10 measures long at the beginning and the place where it comes after the second verse after that. So it's just a little longer than you would expect it to, that it makes you kind of wonder what's going on here. Okay. And then the vocals come in, and the vocals, it almost seems to me like the beginning of a musical. Does that makes, I mean, the Life in the Empire State, the heart is a kick in the young man's stride. I stab myself back into the night, one heel in front, one heel behind. Life in the Empire State. It's rousing somehow. It sounds like it's the beginning of an overture to something.
Yeah, there's probably some aspects, you know, and again, when you mentioned the 10 measures, the odd measure, whatever, we never practice songs before we record them. Never. Not in the entire history of the group have we ever sat down as a full band and say, we're going to rehearse this song for 30 times. We've always just began recording and then worked our way backwards, building from the roof down. And so on Empire State, I would have been sitting, I remember, like in a chair with a guitar, and Jimmy, our drummer, would have been, you know, next to me, and I just would have started the riff, and he would have come in, and I wouldn't have been counting in my head necessarily. I would have been more feeling, okay, here's where I think I'm going to start singing. Here's where I go. And, you know, at times it frustrated the hell out of Dave Fridman, because it would be an odd measure, or it would be not necessarily on a click track in time where you could easily cut it up or come in on a beat. And that was, and probably still remains, one of the elements of how we write our songs, or record them, I should say, is that we don't rehearse them. We just begin the recording process as if this is the version, the take. And then sometimes it gets expensive, Mark. Sometimes you got to go back and do an awful lot of freaking erasing and say, gosh, that wasn't the way to do it. Let's redo it. But initially, that's how we did it. And that's why Empire State would have some push and pull to it. It would have some ebb and flow, and maybe some moments that didn't seem to exactly line up the way you might do it. It's also why some of the songs are really long, because it just felt like that when we were playing. And in hindsight, you'd say, oh boy, I wish we could have cut out another four measures or something like that. It goes on for a bit. But at the time, it just felt like that in the studio when you were recording.
So something like, I mean, you've got these definite parts that come out in the instrumental. So you finish a verse and you've got this acoustic guitar solo in some strange mode for a while. It's actually kind of mixed a little low. And then you've got the interesting, what is it, a muted trumpet over very loud cymbals for, like, that's a little section. And then you've got the main melody, I guess, that comes in, this flute thing. And then this,
Again, you were beginning, you could see us beginning literally on record to orchestrate perhaps in a more conventional way. But it took a while. All the doo-doo-doo-doos were written on guitars, you know, or it's on a flute, and then we do it on a penny whistle or something like that. And yeah, we're describing the sections exactly the way you did. It wasn't, oh, here's the B-flat ninth section into C-14. We describe them like you did. Hey, there's the trumpet freak out. There's that muted section of warbliness. That's all we would go by. And everyone would lock into that imagery as opposed to the notes or the melody even. You'd lock into the imagery. And that's how we would describe it to Jimmy Chambers and say, hey, Jimmy, at this point, we want you to swell more like oceanic waves than something else. And he'd sort of take it from there and interpret it. And Dave Fridman would do the same. A lot of it was just in the moment. When we record in Mercury Rev, it happens very quickly. There's not these long, open-ended, what are we going to do now, fellas? Everybody is bringing ideas, and it happens in a very dense flurry of action.
So this mostly has that same one chord running throughout it, and it's during this flute part. Yeah, I think it doesn't even happen the first time, where finally during the flute riff is going a few times, then the bass does a jump, and suddenly the whole thing sounds nice and pretty. Like, finally there's been a chord change, or maybe it's just something the bass is doing. Again, is that how do these things get planned? Or was that just something that Dave would do at the time? Like, oh, okay, I'll just jump up here while that flute riff is still going, or is this...
Well, I think he was working with the same imagery we all were. as well as having to engineer the session. So he's playing his bass while he's recording the flute. And again, it took a while for that language and that trust to come around, but we were all generally on the same page, especially for that album. You know, everybody was very musical at that time. Everybody was willing to do some things that weren't standard rock and roll. Again, at that time in 95, 94, Britpop was at the height. Everything was Rickenbacker, jangly guitars, 3-minute songs, punchy drums, very simple structures, simple guitar leads. And here we were beginning to really accentuate oboes and horns and trumpets and things. So we had to have a lot of trust in each other because there wasn't a lot to go on commercially around us to say, this is the formula for success, boys. I found it. If anything, it was the opposite. We're doing 7-minute songs using Steve Reichian motifs and freakouts from flugelhorns. You know, if you want to find your way into the budget, then there's not a quicker way.
Do you feel like you still have enough of that element in the new album, the freakout that you're talking about? And maybe it's just the tone and volume of the drums at some place in here that it turns into that acid thing that was characterizes the sound of your first couple albums more so than anywhere else on the recent album. And I don't know if that's just because you're better at mixing now, and so it just doesn't get that, or whether it's just a conscious, you know, we're older and we don't have to have things get to that level of frenzy at any point.
Well, I don't know if it's the mixing and feeling this, but it was just the playing was very frenzied and something mm-hmm. we were really enamored with and something we really wanted to stretch out as far as we could. You know, we're not jazz musicians. We're not prog rock aficionados. We're not able to carry these long Yes-like sequences on an album that are really calculated and thought out. And maybe in recent records, you know, you're always looking to explore parts and aspects of the gem that you haven't seen or found yourself confronted with before. And yeah, I like feedback, and we do a lot in live, and we do stuff like that. But as an artist, you're always looking for some element that is somewhat fresh or challenging to you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's probably the biggest reason why you haven't heard a trumpet freak out necessarily on the recent Mercury Rev record. It's because we probably have been doing it in experimental ways on other projects we've been doing. We do a lot live stuff that's very different than Mercury Rev, more avant-based. And that's where we begin to, you know, get our rocks off or exhaust those moments.
So I guess getting back to the 7 years between albums, you know, I understand not feeling the need to be so in the thick of the music business, but are you still writing at the same pace you were writing before? Or how does the actual creative work on a day-to-day basis look now for you?
I write the same pace. We have tens and tens of songs that didn't make it onto the recent record. And the process itself only seemed to deepen and accelerate over the 7 years. And I probably could have released some songs with Grasshopper 4 years ago, but maybe they might have been a bit premature, or maybe we needed to exhaust some ideas over the 6 years in order to get down to the distilled substance for the 7th year that made the new record. You know, sometimes just because you've written a lot of songs doesn't mean they're ready. And it's a lot like ripping, I don't know, shoots of plants out of the soil too early. You pull them out too early, they're going to be bitter. You leave them in too long, they're going to be rotted. And some of that just took a while to be patient with what was coming out of the sort of unconscious writing. And that's why the 7 years doesn't faze me. I know it doesn't necessarily always help a band to go away for that long. People forget, there's new bands, they move on, whatever the case may be. But I didn't find myself dwelling on any of that. You know, I had to trust that the right songs would come out at the right time and in the right way, which eventually came through Simon, Raymond, and Bella Union.
So you're saying that some of that output, though, that creative activity in the meantime has come out in these other projects that you're working on?
Yeah, for certain. It exhausts itself, or maybe it was just a momentary phase. You were enjoying some element of music, and then you did it, and you could move on. You know, sometimes that's the case in these mm-hmm. longer periods of quiet. And overall, you know, we're heading into our 50s now. Life happens. It's not like when you're 21 where you have the rock and roll band and that is your life. As you go on, life is encompassing of the music you're making. And so, like anyone, life is happening within and without you musically as well. And so the 7 years, you know, I see it as a blessing. Had I released music earlier on, it might not have been what I would consider as strong or as sincere as the music that did come out now.
Well, are we going to hear When You Die or something, that we're going to have 400 hours of cassette tapes that someone can unleash of demo material?
Yeah, that's the thing that I've always lived in great fear of, is that before you die, hopefully we all artists have the sense to make a big bonfire and burn some shit. Because not everything you've ever done needs to come out. Just because you wrote it when you're 14 doesn't make it precious. And so at least for myself, you know, there's a great deal of erasing that goes on. And I don't need to prove my existence in the quiet years by releasing songs or even half-baked ideas to prove that, hey, I was still going, I was still writing, people. Don't worry. A lot of time I have is just quiet. I don't have to sit at a piano 24 hours a day to know that something is brewing inside of me.
Like, I imagine the lyrics to Autumn's in the Air were probably written in one sitting. How do you refine these things?
Sometimes they are. When you're fortunate, you'll have those holes, like, songs that come in 20 minutes there. Mm. And sometimes you'll have phrases that come in little bursts. And then maybe,
right.
You know, 6 months later, another little burst comes. And it's up to you as the artist to connect the little subtle thread that leads to the back to the earlier burst. And that's the beauty of the art as you get older, is you begin to connect the threads that are very subtle, silvery, invisibly, between moments in time that don't have to be linear, you know. The better the artist you are, the less linear you begin to approach music and the less linear you begin to listen to it. And that's a big moment of liberation, I think, for just about anybody in the arts.
Well, thank you so much for doing this. Let's give a little introduction to the last song that we're just going to leave people with. It's also from the recent album, The Light in You, called Central Park East. I put this last instead of first mostly because it was longer. It takes even longer to get going, but it has a similar joyful, just a really strong mood, which is what made me think that, you know, something like Autumn's in the Air, you must have just sat down and just snapped it out. But I also understand what you're saying in terms of, yes, the main image can then evoke a lot of work on the music, which then evokes further work on the lyrics, that these things can emerge in tandem. And even though it's still very intuitive, it's still very authentic and not contrived, I would say, but I can see how something like either of these two songs from your recent album could pour out a little slowly over time.
Well, not everything, you know, has to be this very fast, frenetic money shot that happens in the first 20 seconds, and then you're stuck sitting around staring at each other for the next 3 minutes. You know, like books, like good films, sometimes it's just an inkling at the beginning. It's just a moment in the first chapter that begins to set subtly all the marbles in motion for later on. And that's probably a lot of the way that we've approached songs and maybe albums and maybe in hindsight the whole career of it all. If it doesn't have to begin with a gunshot, it doesn't have to begin with a giant explosion, a splatter across the screen. It can begin with just a look, a small, subtle change in lighting that begins to not only foreshadow what's coming, but also begins a trajectory to it. You know, and Central Park, Autumn's in the Air, and some of the stuff earlier in our time, you know, that's what we're working with. We're working with chapters and scenes in a film. We're not trying to make this one music video where everything has to grab you in the first 14 seconds or you walk.
I guess I don't mean just the beginning chronologically within the song that, you know, these things can take, but in the creative process itself, that too many of my songs are like you describe holes where I'm in some manic mood and I scribble some stuff down and have the melody right there. And that's basically the song. And I could record it that night and I could work on it for 3 years more. It'll sound a little better, but pretty much that's the song. And that's almost the only way that I can write because of just my short attention span or something. But you're providing a good model for me of a more patient approach, perhaps.
Well, it's probably just the way that I live my own life, as corny as it sounds. I'm a pretty big work in progress. You know, I try not to hold on to a Jonathan from 95 or 98 or 87 or something. I see myself as, I want to make some new mistakes. I just don't want to make the old ones over and over again. So with that, I have to be a little bit kinder to myself and see it as a process that's happening. And it's not specific to me. I didn't invent it. I'm not here to make it sound like it's only important because it's me. It goes on in life, and I see myself as that process of unfolding, of changing, of saying, hey, I used to see things like this, but you know what? Now I've got a little wider view of something. And again, that's the unfolding process of orchestration. It's the unfolding process of writing songs in Mercury Rev. And, you know, for a lot of bands, their first album sounds like their most recent, even if there's 25 years between them. And that's not usually the case with us. And that's okay. I don't want the first album to sound like the most recent one. You know, it's that famous Muhammad Ali saying, if you think the same way now as you did 30 years ago, you've wasted 30 years. And for me, that's what I would sort of hold myself up to as a post to lean on and say, I'd like to know that in some way there is some growth. You know, I won't pretend that it's all positive, but I would like to know that in some way there is some change. There is some different light, some new colors added in. And approaching a new album for Mercury Rev, I'd approach it the same way as, you know, I'd like to see if I could reveal some new shades of the spectrum of colors to things. And if I can't, then I can look back and say, boy, you know, I got some bigger work to do than I thought.
Well, I very much enjoyed over the past couple of weeks having these new shades shine upon me. I had seen you guys live in, I don't know, around 1999, maybe 98 in Austin, opening for REM and Wilco. But just based on that show, I would not have pictured Central Park East coming out of that same source. And it's awesome that you're still doing this and that you're putting as much of yourself into it as you are.
Hey, thanks a lot, man. All the best to you.
The sun through the clouds, shining on the cobblestones, I wade through the crowd, lost in my thoughts. Am I the only lonely boy to ever walk in Central Park? Central Park. champagne glasses spilling out, daydreams on the ground, wondering where we went wrong, and if I'll ever get another chance to dream along. Hey, can you tell me, wise old horse with scars, am I the only lonely boy to ever walk this lover's path? Am I the only lonely boy to ever walk in Central Park? Am I the only lonely boy who's ever walked in Central Park?
All right, super long episode, great discussion. I found Jonathan at the time a little hard to read, very much free of irony in a way that I find a little hard to relate to, but I think he really got into this. And this gave me kind of a picture of a whole new way to do music, at least different than what I do on a day-to-day basis, which is frankly not that much. I debuted my first live four-piece acoustic unit recently. Looks like we're going to be playing more during the summer, so between learning 2 hours of music for that and recording and mixing these music podcasts, I have not done much recording so far in 2016 at all. And I suppose one of the ways of reacting to that is just to relax, to take a longer view, to say, I'm going to sketch out this song now, but I don't expect it to be done for a couple years. I don't think I'm going to be taking that path anytime soon, but perhaps 15 years from now, really sitting back and crafting the magnum opus to pull in a lot of session musicians to play. That does sound appealing. Next time, we're going to have Craig Wedren, who is in Shudder to Think and does a lot of soundtrack work now. Like Jonathan, he had a lot to say about his music. It'll be another pretty long episode. I do think, in the interest of making life less frenetic, I'm not going to try so hard at this point to release one of these every single week, but neither am I going to slip to once every 2 weeks. The pattern is looking, once every 9 days or something at this point. I think with some of these artists that have been recording for a long time, when they've got 20 albums, and I've never really been into them before, trying to do all my prep in a week is a little unrealistic. So I want to make sure this stays fun. And until I get a big enough audience to warrant putting commercials in here and making some substantial income off this, this schedule might be a little erratic. But I do really enjoy doing these, so by all means, you should develop a psychological dependence on this podcast. Please spread the word. Go to the iTunes store, give us a nice rating, nice review, post it to your social media.
If you've not ventured onto my other podcast, The Partially Examined Life, I want to point out that one of our last episodes featured former Nakedly Examined music guest Tim Quirk on the sociology of musical taste. Well, all right, so long for now. This is Mark Lintonmeyer signing off.